This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting English R&B artist and soul singer James Hunter, Sunday, March 10th at 8 p.m. The Aladdin is located at 3017 Southeast Milwaukee in Portland. Tickets for James Hunter on March 10th at the Aladdin box office and aladdin-theater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
The president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, has died of cancer.
Despite controversy on targeted killings, John Brennan is confirmed as the new CIA director by a Senate committee.
The number of Oregonians employed goes up, but so does the state's unemployment rate. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 5th, 2013. I'm Don Merrill.
And I'm Ren Green. Two Portland police officers shot and killed a man at 10:45 Monday night on the top level of a parking garage at Northeast 7th Avenue and Lloyd Boulevard. The officers were at the garage for undisclosed reasons when they were fired upon by 32-year-old Santiago A. Cisneros III. After the shootout, Cisneros was found lying on the concrete next to a shotgun and was pronounced dead at a local hospital. The unidentified officers are on paid administrative leave and will be formally interviewed this Thursday, more than 48 hours after the incident. A Multnomah County grand jury is currently reviewing another fatal shooting by Portland police last month in the parking lot of Portland Adventist Medical Center.
Oregon's unemployment rate increased to 8.4% in January, and the state added 4,200 jobs. To understand how both can happen, KBOO talked with Nick Balachek, the Oregon State Employment Economist, for more.
The Oregonian reported that Oregon gained 4,200 jobs in January, yet the unemployment rate went up to 8.4%. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with Oregon's economy as compared to the rest of the country right now?
Oregon's economy is pretty much following the rest of the nation. The unemployment rate was virtually unchanged. It just ticked up 0.1%. And in the U.S., the unemployment rate was also virtually unchanged.
Are there any jobs in the state that have remained relatively unchanged, while the state and the nation have been going through these gyrations in job numbers?
Well, we've seen small job gains throughout all the major sectors. Some of the sectors that have been growing more rapidly are the professional and business services, and also education and health services have been growing. One sector that has stagnated, though, is construction. We really haven't seen any recovery in the construction sector as far as the number of jobs goes.
Does the state put out any kind of information to help people who are looking for employment sort of pick what jobs will be available by the time they finish whatever training or schooling they have to do?
Yes, we create 10-year occupational projections, and those are available on our website, www.qualityinfo.org. And you can look at over 700 occupations and see where the most likely opportunities are going to be over the decade.
How have those projections been in terms of accurately predicting where the jobs will be in the future?
Well, they always seem to be a little optimistic because it's very difficult to predict recessions. So they're assuming that the economy will just kind of go ahead as it is, but as we all know, the recessions hit and there's never as many jobs as we thought there would have been.
Does Oregon have any kind of historical, statistical variation in terms of how fast or how slow its unemployment rate goes up or down? I mean, like, there's a historical average, and how close or off is Oregon from that historical average?
Oregon always tends to be a little bit higher than the nation when it comes to the unemployment rate. Right now, we're in that really familiar situation. We're a half of a percentage point higher than the nation, which isn't too far off from our historical trends.
Okay. Are the state agencies doing a pretty good job of finding work for people who are eligible and qualified to do that work?
Well, we provide a lot of services. My division provides a lot of information about the types of jobs that are available and the wages that those jobs pay through our website. And the rest of the agency provides a lot of help at our local field offices.
And if people want more information about those services, where can they go?
They can find out where their closest field office is by going to www.workinginoregon or check out our statistics site, www.qualityinfo.org.
That was Oregon State Economist Nick Balachek talking about Oregon unemployment rates.
Early next month, more than 28,000 Oregonians will be notified of cuts to their unemployment benefits due to across-the-board cuts in federal spending known as the sequester. The cuts will affect people receiving federal emergency unemployment compensation, or EUC. Recipients of regular unemployment benefits will not be affected. In addition, federal grants for employment services will be cut, weakening job search assistance programs and employer recruitment activities. People can apply for EUC money when regular state benefits expire after 26 weeks. Nearly 1,000 Oregonians apply for the federal emergency funds every week, unable to find work. The sequester will result in a 10.7% cut to all EUC checks, regardless of size. The cuts go into effect on March 31st and will be reflected in checks mailed to EUC recipients on April 7th. Recipients will be officially notified of the cuts by mail in the first week of April by the Oregon Employment Department.
The Oregon Parent Teachers Association is pleased that the Oregon legislature has found money to fund programs for kids for the next 2 years, although it admits that some districts and members will face challenges. PTA legislative advocate Otto Schell talked with KABU about the PTA and some of those challenges.
You are a voice of parents and children to the legislature as well as to the school districts?
Sure. Well, me and many hundreds, if not thousands, of other wonderful volunteers who are all part of the PTA world.
Okay. What do you think about the spending plan that was drafted by Senators Devlin and Buckley to set aside $6.5 billion for K-12 spending? I mean, how does the Oregon PTA feel about that?
Well, we've been part of an education coalition that is fairly broad, advocating for a better budget number in Salem for our students. I'm happy to say that this is the first year in, I believe, 10 years that we've actually seen an improvement on the share of the state general fund budget that's going to K-12 schools. Now, the $6.75 billion spread out over 2 years over the entire state still leaves some challenges for some districts, but it's a definite improvement over where we were even earlier this year.
Right. Where were we earlier this year?
Well, the governor had proposed a $6.15 billion budget, and when you talk about billions, it seems like such a substantial, almost a hard to wrap your head around number. But at 6.15, the proposed budget was going to result in the layoff of a lot of teachers, putting districts in a position to lay off staff and lose days, et cetera. At 6.175, we think there's a little bit more of an opportunity for most districts, not all of them, but to try to have a little bit of stability. To they aren't likely to make a big progress on class size or building back any programs just yet, but we hope that at $6.75 billion, it's a start of a reinvestment in schools in Oregon. The commitment to try to stabilize schools and to protect the programs that are so critical for kids is a really important step forward. At the same time, there will be districts that will be struggling to figure out how to balance everything up and still meet the needs of their students.
So then, from your perspective, is it sort of like this is the best solution for the good of the most people?
I think that it serves a wide number. There are about 550,000 students in Oregon in K-12. It will go a long way to meet the needs of those students. But at the same time, we know that after many, many years of cutting and shrinking and squeezing programs and laying off teachers, we have a lot of work to do to build back to where we think schools should be for all Oregon kids.
So do you know off the top of your head which districts are going to face the kinds of challenges that you were talking about?
In Portland, I think that it comes out to either hold steady or maybe a small opportunity to build back, because we also have local money that the taxpayers have been very generous in supporting PPS. I will say Hillsboro, Beaverton, North Clackamas, and Salem-Keizer, all fairly substantial-sized districts, still have budget challenges that will be facing them, and how they get to a solution will be, you know, their task at the local level.
The Oregon legislature has proposed funding K-12 education by tapping into the public employees' retirement system to the tune of more than $700 million over 2 years. Although Mr. Schell didn't speak directly to that, he did admit that parents in the PTA who are also teachers may face challenges.
From the PTA perspective, I'm not the guy to tell you how many teacher members we have. Many teachers come to PTA wearing their parent hat. So they're teachers and their parents, and they are frequently PTA members in either their school where they teach or the school where their children go to school. We try to support the teachers and the principal and the other staff within the school. So when we see layoffs, we know what that means, both for those families, those teachers, those staff, but also for the students that are in our community. So, you know, it's been a challenge, a huge challenge. The good news about the current budget proposal from the co-chairs is that we're going to at least make a little progress for this biennium, this two-year period of the budget.
That was PTA Legislative Advocate Otto Schell talking about the organization's legislative agenda.
With some minor revisions, Portland's proposed sick leave policy will head to a vote at City Council this month. The new version retains the requirement that Portland employers provide up to 40 hours annually of sick leave, either paid or unpaid, depending on the size of the business. The most significant change addresses when employees can begin using their sick leave. In Commissioner Amanda Fritz's original proposal, employees would be allowed to use sick leave after 6 weeks of employment. The revised proposal requires that employers wait 90 days before using accrued sick leave. Other changes include removal of collective bargaining provisions and the addition of a certificate of compliance for employers. The revisions came from a series of task force meetings organized by Commissioner Fritz and Commissioner Dan Saltzman. The City Council has scheduled hearing this Thursday at 3 p.m. and is expected to vote on the ordinance on March 13th.
The Boys and Girls Club has teamed up with the City of Beaverton to open new transitional housing for homeless youth. Beaverton used a federal grant to purchase the building and gave it to the Boys and Girls Club with the stipulation that it must be used to provide affordable housing and support services for at least 30 years. A project coordinator for the City of Beaverton called the event a milestone for the city, the first time in memory that the city has invested in housing for the homeless. Qualified youth age 18 to 23 can live rent-free in the new apartments for up to 2 years as part of the Boys and Girls Club Transitional Living Program. They will also have access to counseling and support services to help with gaining employment and enrolling in school. In 9 years, the Boys and Girls Clubs have placed 103 youth in the program. 97 have graduated. The first resident moved in on February 25th. There is currently space for 5 more 18 to 23-year-olds.
A major campaign donor to Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is set to profit from developments along the planned MAX line between Portland and Milwaukee. Stacy Whitbeck Incorporated is the construction firm that built most of Portland's public transit rail system. The company currently holds $342 million in contracts for the future Portland to Milwaukee MAX line. They also purchased 3.25 acres of land next to the route in 2011 for an office building and future development. After a January meeting between Stacy Whitbeck President John Bollier and the mayor, Hales ordered city employees to accelerate land use planning studies tied to the MAX line. These studies could result in a rezoning of the land that would likely change the property from industrial to commercial use. A senior managing director for a Portland commercial real estate assessment company said this change could double the value of the land. The mayor's ties to Stacy Whitbeck go back at least a decade. Hales used to serve as senior vice president for an engineering firm that consulted with the company on transportation projects. The Stacy Whitbeck construction firm was among Hales' top campaign donors, contributing $25,000 to his campaign. John Bollier, the president of the company, also personally contributed $6,000.
A bill has been proposed in Salem that would require a $10 registration fee for all bicycle riders in Oregon. Bicycle Transportation Alliance spokesperson Will Van Loo talked about how and why the past efforts for the fees haven't been successful.
This type of fee has been proposed in Oregon before and in some other states as well by a number of different folks. But to my knowledge, the programs that have been proposed have never been able to show that they could pay for themselves. So the revenue that they brought in or were scheduled to bring in were actually going to be less than the administrative and enforcement costs associated with them. About 90% of Bicycle Transportation Alliance members also drive a car, and so they're paying the same fees and taxes just that everybody else is. And since bicycle damage or bicycle traffic causes so little damage to the roads, there are some cases where a person who owns a car and rides a bicycle most of the time may already be paying more into the transportation budget than the cost of wear and tear that they cause. So it's hard to say blanket across the board whether a fee in any form would be a net benefit for everybody or somebody without having more details on that fee and where the money goes.
Mr. Van Loo said that one of the issues surrounding why there aren't more people on the road has to do with how safe they feel on the road on a bike.
Safety is a really important concern. That is the thing that's cited most often as a reason for why people don't get on the road on a bicycle, is they either aren't safe or they don't feel safe. And our legislative agenda this session is focused almost entirely on issues pertaining to safety on the roads, both for people who ride bicycles and for anybody who's going to be out using the road. So we really do believe that safety is an important component of making sure that we all have a livable community to transport ourselves in.
So the Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a lobbying organization?
We do have some staff that goes to the Capitol. That is one component of what we do. We speak with state and federal legislators on issues pertaining to bicycling. We also have education and encouragement programs as well.
Transportation Alliance. That was Will Van Loo with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance talking with KABU about proposed statewide bicycle registration fees.
A tentative agreement has been reached between Salem-Keizer Area Public Transit and Century West Engineering Corporation. Century West is the engineering firm that county officials hold responsible for the structural defects at the Courthouse Square and Transit Mall in Salem. The $34 million project now requires $23 million in repairs. The building was completed in 2000 and started showing both structural and non-structural flaws within the first 2 years after opening. Continued deterioration forced the city to vacate the building 2 years ago, a move that cost the county nearly $1 million. The county previously reached a $1.8 million settlement with the two other major contractors in July 2010 and a $9.5 million settlement with affiliated FM insurance company. County officials say in light of these settlements, they do not expect to have to borrow money to cover the repairs. The amount of this tentative settlement is still unknown.
George Zimmerman, the man facing second-degree murder charges for the shooting death of teen Trayvon Martin, is back in February 2012, and Zimmerman's legal defense team stunned the courtroom Tuesday by announcing that Zimmerman will skip the Stand Your Ground hearing, which was supposed to take place in April. But the defense team left open the possibility of asking for a Stand Your Ground hearing trial before June, which would give the defense more time to prepare their case. Zimmerman was a neighborhood watch captain during the time of Martin's murder and is supposed to be protected under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. He would also have immunity if his claim of self-defense in the shooting could be proven. But Zimmerman's defense team is reported to be apprehensive about going through the trial, fearing that prosecution teams could pick apart Zimmerman's case if the judge rejected the claim. This would then leave the hearing open for prosecutors to search deeper into the testimony. The prosecution has also a witness who was reported to have been on a phone call with Trayvon Martin during the time of the murder, but Zimmerman's defense team did not find the witness credible during the Tuesday trial.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6:00. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes guests from an Oregon City organization, The Living Room, to talk about their programs that help LGBT and queer youth. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock focuses on the privatization of public schools and a speech from Daniel Whale on charter schools. Tomorrow's weather is 80% showers with a high of 48 degrees.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a diabolical idea from the hottest level of hell, down where Wall Street's fiendish schemers and scammers dwell. Conspiring with state lawmakers, such powerhouse banks as J.P. Morgan Chase, U.S. Bank Corp., and Bank of America have devised a new way to enrich themselves by, get ready to gag, ripping off unemployed Americans. As Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. These bankers have slithered into the process that states use to pay monthly jobless benefits to hard-hit people. These payments used to be mailed to recipients or deposited directly into their bank accounts. But Wall Street lobbyists, using phrases like win-win, have enticed states to switch the payment system to bank-issued debit cards. This saves states the cost of mailing or direct depositing the money, but banks don't do anything for free. Someone must pay for distributing the benefits to individuals. Guess who? Yes, the unemployed. Now, each month, the cost of distribution plus a generous profit for the bank are automatically deducted from the meager benefits the jobless receive. Then the bank hits them with ATM fees and other charges for using the card. How handy! In the sense that it puts bankers' hands right into the pockets of unemployed people, forcing those in dire need to pay millions of dollars in unnecessary fees to some of the richest bankers in the land. This is Jim Hightower saying, California, Indiana, Kansas, Maryland, and Nevada don't even allow recipients the choice of direct deposit, forcing them into the clutches of a particular bank, which violates federal law. But the whole system of profiteering on jobless people is an obscene violation of America's fundamental sense of morality. For information and action, go to National Consumer Law Center at nclc.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The stock market climbed to new heights today, clearing 14,200 for the first time in its history. The previous high was reached on October 9, 2007, in the days leading up to the financial crisis. But while stocks are achieving new highs, workers' wages are reaching an all-time low in the U.S. In fact, the richest 1% of Americans have captured nearly all the income gains achieved during the current recovery, while everyone else has actually lost ground in terms of income since the economy bottomed out. In the last quarter of 2012, U.S. corporate profits hit an all-time high of $1.75 trillion. Meanwhile, wages for workers hit an all-time low in the third quarter, falling to 43.5% of the GDP.
Charges filed by both sides of the labor dispute at the Port of Vancouver indicate negotiations are becoming heated between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, Local 4, and the employer, United Grain Corporation, in the wake of last month's lockout. In documents filed with Clark County Superior Court on February 28th, the employer contends that a union official sabotaged equipment, causing $300,000 in damage. The suit alleges the damages occurred in late December and were committed by a member of the union's bargaining team. The ILWU has now charged United Grain Corporation with unfair labor practices at the National Labor Relations Board's regional offices in Seattle on Monday. According to the union complaint, the action, quote, constituted loss of employment based on anti-union animus and sweeping unilateral change of terms and conditions of employment, end quote. Our request for an interview with someone from the union was declined, and no official could be reached at the Pacific Northwest Grain Handlers Association for comment.
Scientists are cautiously optimistic about a child in Mississippi who appears to have been cured of HIV. According to Dr. Hannah Gay, the 2.5-year-old girl was born with HIV, but for the last year has shown no sign of the disease. The child has not taken antiviral medication for the last year. She has a normal life expectancy and is considered highly unlikely to be infectious to others. The doctors say they believe the recovery of the child is because they treated her with three antiviral drugs within 30 hours of birth. The standard regimen for children born with HIV is a single drug. In this case, the mother had not received any treatment at all for the disease prior to giving birth, so doctors gave the baby extra antiviral medication. They expected the girl to be dependent on the drugs for life, but doctors were surprised when the amount of virus present in her blood fell below detectable levels within a month. Now, 2.5 years later, the child has shown no viral load at all for the past year. Her doctors are now working to determine if this is a rare response or if the technique will be a possibility for other newborns infected with HIV.
A massive ad campaign of 100 billboards has hit the streets of Washington, D.C., showcasing the faces of Jewish Americans saying boldly, "AIPAC does not speak for me. Most Jewish Americans are pro-peace. AIPAC is not." The ad campaign began Sunday, March 3rd, to coincide with the annual policy conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and is designed to challenge the lobbying group's influence on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. AIPAC, one of Washington's most powerful lobbies, is currently holding their annual lobbying days in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of lawmakers and Vice President Joe Biden are in attendance at their annual gala this year. Josh Rubner, with the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, pointed out this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia that maintaining the current level of U.S. aid to Israel is one of the group's main lobbying priorities this week.
When the sequestration deal first came about in 2011, there was a bit of a conversation about whether AIPAC would lobby to try to get that money back if it came to sequestration, or they would let it go, not wanting to single Israel out for special treatment. And initially, AIPAC came out and said, no, we wouldn't be lobbying for adding this money back in if there are across-the-board budget cuts. But it appears now that sequestration has happened and Israel's military aid package has been cut by about $250 million. There were indications in the press that as AIPAC goes up to lobby Capitol Hill today, that they will be lobbying to exempt this money from being deducted from Israel's military aid package. That even if Israel gets $250 million cut from its military aid budget, that still means that Israel is getting close to $3 billion, about $2.75 billion worth of weapons from the United States in this fiscal year. And those weapons will do an immense amount of damage to Palestinians who are living under Israel's oppressive rule in the occupied territories.
Jewish Vote for Peace, which helped sponsor the billboards, says that AIPAC's support for military buildup and settlement expansion makes peace impossible. Last year, AIPAC aggressively lobbied the U.S. government to oppose U.N. recognition of Palestinian statehood. However, a recent poll by pollster Jim Gerstein showed that 82% of Jewish Americans support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In another poll by Zogby, a majority of Jewish Americans listed Israeli settlements as illegal or a problem for future peace deals, but AIPAC has refused to publicly condemn any settlements. The ads can be seen throughout the D.C. metro area, including the two metro stops closest to the AIPAC gala.
U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden today joined 11 other senators to confirm the appointment of John Brennan for the CIA. The appointment will now go to the full U.S. Senate, where it is expected to be approved. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with former CIA officer Ray McGovern about the approval of John Brennan by the committee, including the surprise vote of Ron Wyden.
Wyden put out a statement that he's happy that the administration has provided access to the documents he requested on targeting killings just this morning. What do you think about that he now has that access, and that's why he changed his mind on the confirmation?
That's a fig leaf. What Wyden says in this statement is that the administration has now provided our committee with full access to documents outlining the president's authority to conduct targeted killings of Americans. My God. Hasn't he read the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution? Maybe you ought to tell him that it says no person not only just no American or no citizen, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So the first sentence of this statement is way askew. It's as if the writers, the three senators who write it, don't know anything about the Constitution. It says, the president's authority to conduct targeted killings of Americans in counter-terrorist operations. Now, so they have some documents, okay, where the president asserts that authority. The Fifth Amendment be damned. And then they talk about, well, now we're going to talk about authorities that can be used in the United States. That was one of the burning questions. Can the president order drone killings of you and me in the United States without trial, without, you know, acting as a judge executioner and so forth? Well, Wyden doesn't know. He wants to have a debate about this. But meanwhile, we're going to support the nomination of John Brennan, and indeed he did. The whole system smells. These are supposed to be oversight committees, but since 9/11 they have become overlook committees in the real sense of that term. And if you don't have to believe me on that, Senator Lindsey Graham, who sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee, not on the Intelligence Committee, but they have purview over covert action by the Department of Defense. You know what he said? He said, and now what kind of senator or representative is going to hold a hearing, is going to call a hearing on whether the president is exceeding his authority on going after terrorists? I'll tell you, no one. And that's why Congress is AWOL on this issue, end quote. AWOL, for those younger listeners that you have there, absent without leave. So Congress is absent without leave. And when Ron Wyden folds, well, that's an indication that the whole place is going to fold, and we will have no rights. The president has asserted the right to kill us. And now we have a piece of paper explaining that. Do we know it? Have you seen it? No. But they're going to vote for John Brennan anyway.
You talked about Brennan's role in and his support of torture. Do you, as someone who has been involved in intelligence, in the Central Intelligence Agency, think that torture is ever an effective means to prevent attacks?
Torture never gives reliable information. Don't believe me on that. On the very day that George Bush tried to